Thank you. We're a little behind schedule. It'd be great if we can start promptly. That'd be a real help. It'd be great if we could sing up, actually. I'm sitting in the front row. I thought last night maybe it was just us in the back row, but our singing, I thought, well, we might just try and better it a little. I'm sorry, we haven't done as well as the children. Here is their brochure. Joseph, living the dream. And they feel they've got one up on me on that, and they have. Now, we looked at Joseph back in the summer on a Sunday evening, or on a number of Sunday evenings, in St. Helens. And at the time, the paralysingly cringeworthy BBC series You Could Be Joseph was running on the telly. It wasn't long, I have to confess, before I was hooked. I think it had something to do with having teenage children or something like that. But over our 14-week series at St. Helens, I became convinced of the value of taking the Joseph narrative slowly and not rushing through it. And I want to tell you what I think some of the value of it is now as we start. The star of the story is not actually Joseph, nor is it Jacob. The star is really God. And right up front, we need to realise that the reason we have the account of Jacob's family in the Bible is to show us how it is that God goes about keeping his great promise to raise up a people from every nation who will be a blessing to the nations and whom he will bring into his perfect promised land of rest, his new creation. That is the whole agenda of Genesis. Those of you who studied Genesis will know that when it was originally written, there were no chapter headings and there were no verse headings, and that ancient writers used to flag up for us in the stream of text where the chapter headings were by particular statements. And if you look through Genesis, you'll see in chapter 2, verse 5, in chapter 5, verse 1, another time before chapter 11, then right at the end of chapter 11, and indeed back a page in chapter 36, and here in chapter 37, these are the generations of. Those are the major section breaks in Genesis. And every time you come to a phrase, like you've got in chapter 37, verse 2, these are the generations of Jacob, you realise we're onto a new phase, a new chapter, in this great account at the start of the Bible. And that this chapter has got a particular lesson to us to do with the whole theme, and that lesson will run right the way through this chapter, which in this case runs from our chapter 37 through to chapter 50. I hope you understand what I'm saying. So the ancient authors, the way they wrote, was to put these major breaks in to indicate to them to us, because they didn't have their own chapter headings. The chapter headings were put in much, much later. And that was the way of ancient literature. If you go and study the Bayeux Tapestry, you'll find exactly the same thing in a graphic form there. So when we come to the account of Jacob's family, what we've got here is a major section of the whole narrative of Genesis designed to teach us a specific lesson alongside the lesson of Esau's family and Abraham's family and the generations of the heavens and the earth, chapter 2 through to chapter 4, about the way God keeps his promise to raise up a mighty nation from all the nations that will be a blessing to all mankind and through whom God's blessing will come and whom he will bring to his promised land. Now, there are two different ways of handling a piece of narrative like we've got in these 14 chapters. Really, there are just, I think I can count four major points about God. And we could read the whole 14 chapters in our two sessions this morning, and then tomorrow just flag up the four main lessons about God. Alternatively, we could recognize that these chapters were given to God's people as they moved from slavery in Egypt to the promised land, and they were intended to be told and retold, told again and told yet again, over and over again, to teach these lessons to God's people. And actually, the details within each chapter, as you pause and think about this particular incident of the story, you know, I bet your family have got stories like that, that whenever you meet, get told and retold and told again around the dinner table. and you pause on a particular, oh yeah, it was just like that. And the incident, because this is God's story, we're meant to pause and consider the lessons being learned along the way. We have family stories like that in our family. The day the donkey in the back of our family estate broke loose and jumped onto the driving seat. That's a story. It's got a long history to it. It's true. The day my dad soared through the tree while I was still at the top of it. That's a great one. I'm not going to tell you, but it was really funny. Or the day my mother shot my pony, which is a slight bending of the truth to rack up the guilt on my mother's part. But we reckon she did. This story, and I'm still in therapy, this story, with the story of Isaac, Abraham, and Abraham before him, is much, much more significant than those silly little family stories that we all have. The big themes, the four big lessons we learn through this story have to do with God's character. And therefore we hear these big themes recurring all the way through the Bible. And we find them because the Old Testament is designed to direct us to the Lord Jesus Christ. We find them reaching their climax in the death and resurrection of Jesus. Now, just a word on this. Some people read the Old Testament like you and I play Pelmanism. What is Pelmanism in current terminology? What do you call that game? Did you used to play Pelmanism? You know, where you got, it's pairs, isn't it? You know, you lay all the animals, all the cards down. In my day, they were actually had numbers on. Now it's animals, it's a lot easier. Face down, you turn one up, and then somebody else turns the other one. Oh, yes, that's a cow, that's a sheep. You have to remember where the cow is. You put it around, and then the next person, and there you go. Have you ever done that? Have you done that in the last 40 years? Yeah, yes. Okay, good. Yes. Yesterday. Okay, well done, Dan. Good, good. Now, some people treat the Old Testament like that. Oh, here's an idea. Snap. Jesus. We are not designed, in my view, to see a picture of something that Jesus does and then go bang straight through to Jesus like that. Snap. No, I think it's much more like, this is the first time I've ever used this illustration, so it may not work, and it's a bit fraudulent. I think it's a little bit more like Rachmaninoff. Now, yeah, Janet is the cult, I thought of this yesterday actually, so it may not work, but I am culturally pretty Philistine-like. Janet is not. But actually, even before I met Janet, I got to know Rachmaninoff because I had two bits of classical music in my car as I used to drive back from Germany. And one of them was a Rachmaninoff piano concerto. And I listened to it once, oh, that's fair enough. And then I listened to it again, then I listened to it again. And it was only on about the sort of 25th time, it's a long way from Germany, that I realized that what he does when he writes is build themes. Yeah, I mean, I know you know this. He builds themes at the beginning, and then he stretches you out as far as he possibly can as he takes you off into the forest and then down by the river and then over. And then finally it all comes to this immense bang at the end. But unless you know what goes on and understand what goes on at the beginning, when the bang comes at the end, it kind of is a whimper. And in fact, the more you get the beginning, and what's going on is you go down by the river. I don't know if he takes you by the river. It seems like he does to me anyway. Wherever it is, you know, wherever it happens to be. As you understand what's going on there, so you understand the bang at the end much, much better. So there's a way of tackling the Old Testament. You say, oh, yeah, we must chase through and see this in Jesus. Pelmanism. And there's a way of handling the Old Testament. You say, this is God. This is God's rich character. When we come to Jesus, now we're going to understand him much, much better. Because we've been down by the forest glade or whatever it is, and we've seen the wealth of the way God operates. That's how we should read the Old Testament. In my view, some of you may disagree with me, it's a free world. So here are three of what I consider to be the four big themes that I think are introduced for us in this chapter. And because we're meant to read the story over and over and over and over again, I think it's right that we, and some of my friends disagree with me on this, Bible teaching friends disagree with me, I think it's right that we know the beginning from the end. And in fact, I think the author shows us the beginning from the end in the first chapter so that we read it saying, ah, we know where this is going. Now, can we see what God's doing here? Okay, I hope I've made some sort of a defense of the way we're operating. First, Joseph is God's man. There is no doubt that Joseph is highly favoured by his father Jacob. He is Jacob's man. Rachel was Jacob's favourite wife. He had to wait 7 years before he married her, and he had to serve his father-in-law another 7 years after he married her, 14 years in all. At first, he couldn't have children by Rachel. There were 10 other children born first, 6 through Leah, Jacob's first wife, 2 through Bilhah, Rachel's cleaning lady, and 2 more through Zilpah, Leah's home help. And finally, after 10 children had been born, Joseph and then Benjamin came along through Rachel, and, poignantly, Rachel died in childbirth as Benjamin was born. So Joseph and Benjamin were favourites, and we can see that stated right up front in this account of Jacob's family in verse 3. Now Israel, that's another name for Jacob, loved Joseph more than any other of his sons because he was the son of his old age. And then verse 3, and Israel made Joseph a robe of many colours. The robe of many colours was a robe of royalty and special favour. In the only other place in the Bible where it's mentioned, it is the princess daughters of King David who wore long-sleeved coats of many colours. So here is Joseph in his multicoloured billabong beach robe. And there is no doubt that Joseph is highly favoured by Jacob. But the dreams show that Joseph was much more than just a family favourite. Dreams in the Old Testament are hugely significant. They're understood to be God's way of communicating to his people. Before we had God's full and final revelation in Jesus Christ, God would use dreams to speak to people. And it was understood that he would give interpretations to his people of the dreams he's been given. Now, of course, with the coming of Jesus, all of us dream dreams and have visions because we have God's full and final revelation. There's no more need for dreams. But we can see the significance of dreams in the Old Testament simply by looking at chapter 40, verse 8, where Joseph speaks about dreams to one of Pharaoh's servants. They said, "We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them." Joseph said, "Do not interpretations belong to God?" Chapter 41, verse 16. Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It is not me. God will give Pharaoh a favourable answer." And now look at chapter 41, verse 32. The doubling of Pharaoh's dreams means that the thing is fixed by God. Now, what does that mean? The doubling of Pharaoh's dreams means that the dream is fixed by God. Well, it means that when Joseph dreams something twice, it's fixed by God. It's absolutely certain. So, Joseph dreams. I think I need to say this. Sheaves are the stalks of corn with grain still on them that are gathered together at harvest time in the days before combines came along and then the grain was thrashed out of them. Did you know that? I'm sure you did. It's harvest time. Joseph has collected his sheaf, the brothers have theirs, all 11 come and bow down to him. And the brothers realise precisely what the meaning is, verse 8, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and his words. What does the doubling of the dream do? Well, it simply serves to confirm the point. So the scene moves from agricultural to astrophysical. This time his parents are involved too. The stakes, therefore, are much higher. And Jacob gets the point. Verse 10, "Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to prostrate ourselves on the ground before you?" Now, nothing could be more clear, could it? See, Joseph is not just Jacob's favourite. This is a statement by God that Joseph rightly shares with his brothers, because it's a revelation from God. It's absolutely right and proper that Joseph goes and tells them. And it's a statement repeated twice that God is going to raise this man up to a position where all of God's people bow down, prostrating themselves on the ground before him. Now, I don't know about you, but, you know, there is a way, isn't there, of reading these Joseph narratives, and particularly verse 37, that paints Joseph out to be a rather self-important, jumped-up twerp. Have you heard that? Who sort of strutted his stuff in his Armani unisex suit before all the rest of his family. I think that is totally to misunderstand the significance of what's going on, because it fails to understand the significance of dreams and of twice repeated dreams that's told to us in the rest of the account. There is no comment from the author to suggest that Joseph is a self-important, jumped-up twerp. Quite the opposite. Joseph is demonstrated to be righteous above his brothers. Joseph is spoken to by God. Joseph is given the revelation. It's confirmed to him by repetition. And it's quite right that he shares it with his brothers, this revelation that has been given to him by the Lord. At the end of the account, Jacob describes Joseph as set apart from his brothers. Jacob tells us that Joseph is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, and Moses describes Joseph as prince amongst his brothers.
At this point, there is a short gap in the original recording.
And think about this in the context of the rest of Genesis. This family, remember, is a family specially chosen by God for the prime purpose of carrying out God's plans. God has promised this family that they will inherit his promised land. This family is to be a blessing to all the nations. This family is to be the family of God whose numbers will multiply until they are a vast multitude that are as numerous as the sands on the seashore, Genesis 12 and so on. Now we're being shown that God will keep his promise to his people through having a man before whom all his people will bow in humble reverence. Let's pause for a moment. Here is a dilemma. When I started teaching Joseph, I wasn't quite sure whether Joseph was a type of Christ. All the way through God's revelation in the Old Testament, we're given pictures of what Christ will be. And because nowhere else in the Bible is Joseph taught specifically as a type of Christ, when I first taught this story, I did it rather tentatively, sort of said, possibly, could he be? And we sort of tiptoed around the subject. The more I've looked at it, the more I think we have to see Joseph as a picture of Christ, and to see in the teaching of Joseph, you know, a Rachmaninoff moment, if you like, but of far greater significance, being shown that, yes, God will fulfill his purposes for his people and for his world to have a nation that is multiplied as the sands on the seashore by raising up one man before whom all his people will bow. And in that sense, this incident back in chapter 37 is totally unlike the BBC's 11-week serial, You Could Be Joseph. Right up front, we need to say to one another, you could not be Joseph. In fact, you must be dreaming if you think you're Joseph. With the BBC, we have 11 weeks of painstaking, cringeworthy viewing as we see the mincing Graham Norton and Andrew Lloyd Webber doing all their stuff on the telly. And we have to wait 11 weeks and we have to endure numerous vote-rigged telephone calls before we're aware of whether it's, you know, Chris or Adam or... I can't remember even who won it now. Who was the bloke that won it? Anyway, he's on the West End at the moment. Now, in this account, God's man is identified for us right up front. Right up front, Joseph is God's man. And he's told us twice that he is going to bring all of his people to their knees before this man. He's God's chosen ruler. And therefore, as we watch this man who has been appointed and commissioned by God, and as we see him being sold into slavery, and as we see him being given over to Potiphar, and as we see him being plunged into prison, and as we see him enduring his slavery in prison, and as we say to ourselves, this is God's man, we should be saying, can God really fulfill his purposes through? Is this really God's way of operating? Is it really God's means of bringing about his plan that he plunges his chosen ruler into such despised position and actually brings his chosen ruler to such exalted position through such humbling and suffering? Is that really the way God operates? And therefore we find ourselves in this kind of Rachmaninoff moment, beginning to build a picture right here in the first book of the Bible, that it is God's way of operating to bring blessing to his people, to raise up a ruler who is humbled, subjected to the most extraordinary injustice, and so on and so forth. Joseph is God's man. Secondly, Joseph's big theme, Joseph's brothers are wicked men. And the point here concerns the world's opposition to God's man. God's man Joseph is raised up amongst wicked men who oppose him all the way. And I have to say that when we studied this last summer, and again as I've looked at it more recently, I find this immensely encouraging, and I really hope you will find it encouraging too. It actually bears relevance to every day of your working week. It has always been the way that God's man will be opposed and hated, despised and rejected by wicked men. Now, I don't know about you, but when we come to Jacob's family, Jacob was pretty dysfunctional as a character. And when we come to Jacob's family, we see one of the most dysfunctional families you'll ever come across. There is the favoritism of Jacob. We've seen it already. Just like Isaac and Rebekah before him, Jacob has his golden boy. He loved Joseph more than any of his sons. There is the hatred of the brothers. Three times we're told. Verse 4, they hated him. Verse 5, they hated him even more. Verse 8, so they hated him. Now, I'm a geographer, one fact, one side. Don't forget your colouring in pens. And therefore, I really like it when things are repeated like that. You know, Joseph's brothers hated him. There's the bitter war within the family. Verse 4, they couldn't speak peacefully to him. Every sentence carried a snide barb or a wounding arrow. I don't know if you've had the misfortune of being in a family like that, or if you're in a family like that now, where, you know, around the table things are said and you know they carry loaded meaning. There's jealousy. His brothers were jealous. There's plotting. Weakness of Reuben. The shame of Judah. There's callous indifference. We read later on that they saw the distress of Joseph's soul. He begged them, and yet they didn't listen. As they looked down into the pit, there he was pleading with them, and yet just callous indifference. There's attempted murder. Verse 18, they plotted to kill him. Verse 31, there's deception. They take his coat, cover it in blood. There's utter hypocrisy. If you notice at the end of the chapter, they join with their father in the mourning. Crocodile tears. And there's unresolved grief at the end of the chapter, as Jacob says, I will go down to my grave weeping. So we could spend our time focusing on this dysfunctional family and their wicked behaviour. That is a theme. We're going to take that in the next session. It's a big theme. But for now, I want us to take the other theme that comes out of this, and that is the hatred, the rejection of Joseph by his brothers. One of the ways to understand what some of these key narratives are really about is to see how the rest of the Bible takes them. Just turn forwards to Acts chapter 7 for a moment. I want us to look at verse 9 and verse 51. Acts 7, Stephen's speech. The patriarchs, jealous of Joseph, sold him into Egypt. Verse 51, you stiff-necked people, uncircumcised in heart and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit. So here is one emphasis from the rest of the Bible on this wicked and dysfunctional family. They behaved as God's enemies always behave, all the way through the Bible. It is a repeated theme through the whole Bible that God raises up his man through whom he will keep his promises to his people. But as he does it, God's man is hated, despised, and rejected by wicked, jealous men. And of course, once we see that, you know, we could play Pelmanism, couldn't we? And we could say, well, we see that so clearly in the Lord Jesus Christ. Clearly God's man, clearly with all of God's authority, and yet those who saw him hated him. Clearly God's ruler, clearly the one before whom every knee will one day bow, and yet those who were confronted by him despised him. Clearly the man whom God had appointed for rescue, and yet those to whom he came would not receive him. It has always been the way with God's people and with God's chosen man that those to whom he comes hate him. And I have to say, there's an immediate application I want us to think a little bit about that I think is and should be of real encouragement to us. You know, I've got to the age where I start to actually read and think about the columnists in the papers. I think that's a pretty sad age. There was a time, you know, when you floated along and the people who read, you know, the broadsheets were really the most interminable bores. And people who actually read The Spectator were even more fascist than your own father. Well, I'm afraid I'm now sort of coming into my father's camp in various regards like that. But if you do read and think about the columnists, you cannot fail to have noticed a growing tide of hostility towards God and his people. Just over breakfast, I was talking to somebody about their own firm who won't allow matched donations to religious organizations. Whereas, it seems extraordinary, the immense secularist agenda. And Janet was saying to me earlier this week, now that the new financial global superpowers of China and India are beginning to raise their heads, what will it be like living in an empire that has not been shaped by Christianity? Well, China may prove us wrong on that. I think it's easy for preachers to be slightly sensationalist and try and paint things out. I mean, things aren't that bad. But, you know, when you come back into the city and when you go into work every day and you are met by this tidal wave of secularist hatred to Jesus Christ, it is easy to find it immensely discouraging. When we go away and discuss this in our groups, I want us to think carefully about how this whole account encourages us as we face the hatred of the wicked world, knowing that it has always been the way that God has an appointed man whom he identifies, who he will raise up, before whom every knee will bow. And yet it has always been the way that God's appointed man will be hated and opposed by wicked men. Personally, I found it immensely encouraging. You may be the only person in your wide circle of family and friends who loves Jesus, and you may find that all the time there are the snide comments, the barbed remarks, Just the sheer wall of hostility. You may be the only one in your office. You may feel that we're a tiny, tiny little rump, which I think we are, actually, at St. Helens, really, in the city of 300,000. It's always been the way that God's man and God's people are hated. Lastly, God is sovereign. Here's the third of our four big themes. God is sovereign in bringing about his good and gracious promises through his man. And, now listen to this, and through the sinful actions of these wicked men. Now, you must catch this. We'll spend some more time on it tomorrow. God is sovereign in bringing about his good and gracious purposes through his chosen man and through the sinful actions of wicked men. He is sovereign over the whole lot. And this, of course, really is the big lesson, I suppose, of Joseph, that God acts sovereignly in all the details in order to bring about the rescue of his people, the gathering in of many, many people from many nations. God uses the actions of the wicked brothers to bring about his plan. He is in charge as they hate. He is in charge as they refuse to speak to Joseph. It is God who is in charge as the brothers express their jealousy. The Lord is sovereign as they plot. It is God who is working out his purposes as Reuben vacillates and eventually fails to do the right thing. God rules as Judah sells Joseph into slavery. As Joseph pleads for his life from the bottom of the pit and the brothers are so callously indifferent, who has got his hands on the controls? God. He's in charge as they go through their crocodile tears and their pretend grief. God rules. And what is more, he is using actively all of these wicked purposes and designs of these evil men to bring about his perfect plan of rescue that he has prepared for his people, such that by the end of this account, as we saw last night, the people are multiplied in number to 70. They have begun to be a blessing to the nations, and God has preserved his people through the man he has chosen and through the wicked actions of evil men. Now, it seems to me that has to be why, up front, we got the double dreams. Just as the double dreams of Pharaoh serve to confirm the point, up front, confirmed for us, this is God's man. So that all the way through we can see all these purposes that are being used, and this man himself, who then gets used to change God's people, which we'll see tomorrow morning, we're being shown God's in charge. It was his purpose from the very beginning. Please note, it's not just that God knew about it in advance. You know, when I was taught this as a young undergraduate, I was taught what is effectively a pretty heretical view by a lovely godly man. And he said, and he knew I was from Cornwall, you know how it is on the Cornish lanes? Sometimes there's a car coming along here towards a crossroads and a car coming along here and you can't see each other because of the hedges and they're both doing a great speed and they come towards the crossroads. And if you were in a helicopter above, you would be able to see that they were going to crash. You've got a sort of foreknowledge of it. And I said, yes, I know exactly how it is. I was in the back of the car when my mother did it, actually. She was in one of those cars. And I think her foot hit the accelerator rather than the brake. You men can draw your own conclusions from that. But I was taught this as foreknowledge. No, it's not foreknowledge, is it? It's not that God, just knew that some people over here were going to choose with their own will to do certain things, and some people over here were going to choose with their own will to do certain things. No, it's deliberate, sovereign, overarching purpose and planning. Deliberate action, such that God takes the wicked actions of evil men and uses them for his own purposes. Now, this is a huge theme that runs right the way through this account and right the way through the Bible. We're going to come to it time and time again in these 48 hours. But let me just draw three little conclusions. A, humility. You know, it may be that you are somebody who is resisting God's sovereign rule. You're holding out. You'll know. I mean, I don't know. I can't see your heart. And you'll know if you're somebody like that. And secretly, you say to yourself, I will not bow to Jesus Christ. There's an area of my life that's just too important to me to bring under his rule. And maybe you're somebody who's actually a militant atheist secretly. And perhaps you're here to try and undermine everything. And secretly, you're on the side of a Richard Dawkins or a Christopher Hitchens. Humility. God will take your greatest attempt to undermine and destroy his work, and in his purposes, he will turn it to his glory. Did you know that? In fact, he laughs at your pathetic resistance. He laughs at it. He chuckles. He just thinks, how pathetic. Humility, too, for God's people. There is a kind of pride, I think, in the self-pity that says, I only am left. And we can, I think, end up feeling sort of rather proudly sorry for ourselves as the only Christian in a militantly secularist establishment, and, you know, wrap ourselves in a little cocoon of self-pitying pride. Humility. It's all part of God's purpose. And if England actually turns into a rampantly hostile atheistic culture, it's God at work to bring about his perfect purposes. Courage. This providential ordering of every event should keep us at it. Oh yes, we're going to find people trying to stop us. Don't be surprised by hatred, jealousy, deceit, plotting. People, even in the Christian world, will fail to do what they should do. And over the next 30 or 40 years, we will find ourselves really in despair at some of the things we do and some of the things our Christian brothers and sisters do. Courage. God isn't derailed. God will accomplish his purposes. And perseverance, which is really the reverse side of courage. Now, I think we're going to take, can we take half an hour, slip by quarter of an hour, have coffee at 11:15, and meet back here at 11:40. Oh, okay. Can we manage that? Let's go then and spend some time thinking about this on our own.